Race Fuels is Australia's leading supplier of racing fuels. And with the new Bowsers at Queensland Raceway, it's never been easier to source your racing fuel trackside. Elf Race 102 is imported racing fuel direct from Europe. Offering power and protection, the Elf Race 102 is a popular fuel with racers seeking gains over pump fuel. Improve your lap times with Elf Race 102. Racefuels.com.au for all your fuel at the racetrack. This is the Race Fuels Grassroots Racing Podcast and your hosts, Darren Smith and Gary O'Brien. A very big welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Race Fuels Grassroots Racing Podcast. And of course, we've had a very big jump into the year. And it's been fantastic to hear John Bowes' story over our first ever two-parter. And I guess totally ignorance on my behalf that that was always going to be a two-parter for that bloke. But it was fantastic to have JB on the Race Fuels Grassroots Racing Podcast. I'm Darren Smith. This is episode 43. I've still got to pinch myself after episode 2, and I am covered in bruises now that we've got episode number 43 underway. That little giggle in the background is pretty much the only time you ever hear the man laugh, and that is a grumpy... No, it's not. It's the great man, Gary O'Brien. Welcome to episode 43, old sport.
Yeah, good to be back, Daz. Any time that you're in discomfort is always creating mirth in my corner.
It does, yes. Every time we've gone to air, you try and push me down the stairs, and that creates you're in a good mood, even for a four-hour production car race with only 9 cars at Phillip Island. We can certainly do that. Gaz, motorsport is getting back underway. It's not really like 2022, is it, where all of a sudden we're emerging out of a couple of year hiatus after the worldwide pandemic, but certainly the season jumps to a massive start, doesn't it?
It does. Like, February's just huge, and that's just the very start. And so basically every weekend of February we're going to be doing something, which has already started, and obviously enduros take up a fair bit of that with the 12-hour.
Certainly does, and I guess we will touch on enduros during our chat today.
As they certainly will, because we've got a guy that's done a couple. And he's done a lot of other things. He's done open wheelers. He's done karts. He's done production cars. A little bit of GT stuff in a roundabout sort of way. I'd like to welcome Stuart Castera.
Thanks very much, guys. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on board.
Fantastic to have you, even though the workday hasn't finished. Obviously, Gary and I from the East Coast, you're right over there in Western Australia. So, thank you very much for taking the time out of Perth Motorsport Tyres and the Dunlop Tyre dealership you guys have there, your family has there and has done for a very long time. We're really rapt that you've been able to take the time and talk to us, Stuart.
No, it's a pleasure, mate. As you say, it's grassroots. And I think about as grassroots as it come, because I've raced against some amazing people and across Australia and the world, and never quite made there where they are. So, but it's always a good experience to race against some of the people we'll talk about. And in particular, coming from WA, there is a good handful of amazing drivers coming from here, Garth Tander and Daniel Ricciardo, come to mind straight away. Our new V8 supercar champion as well. So there's a bit going on over here, but back when I was a lad, it was pretty basic stuff.
Stewie, tell us, hark right back to the very beginning. Your family is absolutely legendary in Western Australian and Australian motorsport, being that both yourself and your father have competed at the very highest levels. Tell us about your very first memory at a racetrack, at a rally stage, at a speedway, or whatever it might have been, when you first, I guess, got the dirt under the fingernails, smelt the avgas or whatever it might have been, and went, yep, this is going to be for me.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, Dad was a pretty big figure in WA and in Australia in sports cars back in the 70s and early 80s when it was a big thing. So, going to Wanneroo, was it called Race Park or Wanneroo Park or something it was called back in the 70s when I was born. he had the fastest car, the noisiest car, and to walk around the pits and say that was my dad was pretty special at the time. It was anybody that came to Wanneroo wanted to have a look at the car and watch it go around. And we still get customers come in today and go, oh, I can still remember the Elfin going around back in the day. So that was my first memory. My second, we spent a lot of time driving across the Nullarbor when I was a kid in the old F100 with a race car on the back. I think some kids were lucky to have ever been across there. I think by the time I was about eight, I'd done it 36 times or something crazy like that. So a lot of time in the back of the either the Toyota Land Cruiser or the F100 or whatever.
See, I tell you what, all pre iPads and smartphones and things, hey, it would have been all about looking out the window and counting the kangaroos.
What, cartridges or cassette players, I suppose, back in those days.
Oh, I can tell you every Kenny Rogers song. Good times looking back. I'm sure at the time it wasn't fantastic, but no, I enjoyed going to Adelaide International, Sandown quite a few times. It was just good days back then when you're a kid and you don't really understand what's going on, but you're in the environment and you're smelling the fumes and it's getting into your blood. And one day when you're a little bit old enough to do it, then it's already there.
So in those days, were you running around with your toy cars and chasing other kids, or were you actually sitting on the fence watching race cars go
Oh no! I watched Dad's race for a couple of laps, and then
around?
you're going to go back to your own little track that you've made in the dirt, or it was along those lines. But yeah, I'm still not a huge fan of watching cars go around, to be honest. I try and do my best, but unless it's a really good close racing, and that doesn't need to be anything spectacular. It could be a Formula V or the Hyundai series, or doesn't matter. As long as if it's good close racing, hard racing, I'll watch it. But I'm not keen on just watching cars go around for the sake of it.
It gets a bit boring watching cars just doing laps, doesn't it? It's sort of like sometimes you go, what are we here for? We need to be, yeah, right. A Formula V race with 15 Formula Vs snaking down the, or 40 Formula Vs like they do in the Victorian Championship, snaking down the straight at Phillip Island can be absolutely spectacular over 10 laps. But,
Yeah, it doesn't get much better.
yeah,
Yeah.
that's right. Just touching, going back, your first memories at being at Wanneroo. At the track there with your dad, that was with the Elfin MS7. You touched on the Elfin. Was that the car you're talking about?
That's the only car I remember. Yeah, but
Yeah.
it cars before that, but that was the one I remember
My absolute favorite racing car, and that is my first memory of being at the racetrack. Sadly, was when Alan Newton throttle stuck open at Calder. I remember
at
standing there
Calder.
watching that happen and just going, "Wow, this is a spectacular game when it goes wrong." But and that car's been one of my favorite right throughout my life. And I remember meeting your dad, and I sort of thought he was a little bit as a teenager, I thought he was royalty. And pretty much within a couple of minutes of knowing him, I was like, I know this guy's a fair way from royalty. He's a serious punter when he gets out on the track, but boy. If grassroots is anything, we probably should have had the two Stewies on here as well.
Yeah, you should have started with him. Could have done a two-part series.
Yeah, that's right. That's
Yeah.
right. Stewie one and Stewie two. So the family, like it is with many people involved in the sport, fam, and any sport, it could be cricket or tennis or lawn bowls, whatever it is. Often you find family following in the footsteps. At what point was it you gave your dad a tap on the shoulder and said, "Hey, how about I do a bit of this?"
Well, it was around 1983, 84, so I was coming up 10 years old. And it was like, well, I'd be keen to get a go-kart. And So one Christmas, I can't remember, I think it was 84. So he was kind of wrapping up his, that was when the big banger sports cars sort of were folding up, and times were a bit tough back in the early 80s. So he was getting out, and I was kind of like, well, might be time for me to have a go. So we got a go-kart and for Christmas, and I remember we took it up to our service station in Kalamunda. And within about 10 minutes, I'd already put it through one roller door and hit a fuel pump and ripped the wheel off. And that was the end of the first go-kart.
Best test day.
Exploring the limits, you might say.
Yeah. It was flat out.
Son, where's that pedal's the one on the left, the brake pedal?
that was it. And then once he'd fixed that up, then the next one we went to Serpentine go-kart track, which is long gone these days, but a fun little old school, what we call an old school go-kart track these days. Lots of corners, not very wide, and good fun. So that was we did a bit of practice for a year or so. And then we sort of got involved with the Hurricane Go-Kart Club out at Wandowie, which is probably the closest one to here. And did a couple of years out there and, got into it from there on.
Were you competitive in the kart when you were actually racing?
Look, I don't remember back quite that far as to competitiveness, but I dare say we wouldn't have started unless I was going to, my old man wouldn't have had let me be half a lap behind or a lap behind. So I think when we started, we were pretty good. And then just build on from that. I still remember I've got some writing off a go-kart at Wandowie from doing a big lunge at the end of the straight and probably my third or fourth race meeting and ripping off all the wheels and coming home with a big scratch in the helmet and concussed. And the mum wasn't very impressed.
I was waiting for how long until mum got mentioned.
But I still got the trophy, of the wheels. It must have been a big crash. I can't remember. But
if you got Matt, if you got marks on your helmet, generally you don't remember those ones.
Yeah. Concussion has a thing about that.
You know, Stewie, They've found in the AFL now that there's a lot of ongoing problems with concussion.
Nothing much wrong with me.
Hasn't hit our sport yet, has it?
Might explain a few things, actually.
Might be a few people that don't agree with that.
So the I remember that you did karting for a bit. Did you travel over to the East Coast and compete with any seriousness during that time when you were in the karts?
The first big meeting I remember doing was the, I think it was about 1987, 88 CIK international meeting at Cockburn Raceway, where it was a proper FIA sanctioned event. And when you look back at the entry grid, Terry Fullerton and a lot of other people came over. And in Europe at that point, they didn't have rookies, as we call them back then. You're not allowed to call them rookies anymore, but. We were racing at, we were 8, 9, 10 years old, and the Europeans were pretty amazed that we were able to go to this massive meeting, and it was just that just opened my eyes, and that was just this is it. There was international class, full methanol, 40 carts on the grid with methanol pumping out their exhaust pipes, and it was just amazing. It still makes me just remember those days. And I just remember after all us kids were walking around making balls out of all the rubber that the carts had ripped off So that was the real thing. You know, that was it for me. That was like, okay, this is actually a serious sport. This is not just something you do on the weekends. People come from all around the world to do that.
Isn't you mentioned the name Terry Fulton. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that the one that Ayrton Senna singled out as his most biggest rival he ever
Biggest
had?
rival.
Yeah, yeah.
But funny enough, I ended up racing for Terry in Europe, but we'll get to that. So that was the first real thing of go-karts where this is actually a proper sport, you know. So yeah, but I mean, we weren't the rich people, so we didn't do a lot over East. I didn't start going over East until I was probably 16 years old. So I'd been in the sport for 8 or 9 years and won numerous state titles, and then it was sort of over East stuff. And yeah, that was really challenging to start with because, you know, as good as you might be on the West Coast, the East Coast guys are that, you know, a step above. So you've really got to lift your game and get on with it. And at that point, we had to have a CAMS license to race over East, because we wanted to do CI, we wanted to do the CIK race meeting in Cairns. No, not Cairns, was it? As a tr yeah, can't remember the track, but so I had to get a CIK, a CAMS license to do that. So we sent our kart over and went to join the New South Wales CAMS organisation and raced over there a few times and got my license, and then we started doing some CAMS race meetings as alongside the AKA.
What was the cart? What was the equipment that you were using at that point? What was the cart that you were on?
Look, when we started out, it was somebody's homemade job, and then we went up to a Speed. I think they were made in South Australia, and then had a lot of Australian-made carts. And I was just talking to a mate of mine the other day, and he goes, "I can't believe some of the carts you used to turn
Well, they'd been through roller doors and taken over fuel drums. That's what they'd been.
Yeah, but I mean.
And been turned into canoes as well.
Exactly. Yeah. He goes, "I can't believe you were driving those cars and doing so well. It was amazing." But then I think we ended up a Carly or CRG was my pick back then when we could get those. Mainly because, you know, a mentor of mine, Mike Sully, that's what he sold. So of course it was the best cart in the world. So you know, that's what we ended up with racing over East and overseas was generally a CIK or a CR or a Carly cart back as they were called then. So
So actually, when you came over for the first time, you said you were a bit overwhelmed by the East Coast competitors. Did you sort of get on top of that pretty quick, or how did all that work out?
yeah, I mean, you know, Oran Park is a different circuit to start with. It's half a go-kart track, half a race car track, and it was pretty intimidating. But and we were racing Clubman as well, which Clubman was never really my thing. That was the Yamaha RS motor. But I'll just quickly backtrack a bit. I think when I was 11 years old, and as you guys know me, I'm not a big fella now. So you could probably imagine how big I was when I was 11 years old. And they were changing the rules at the end of that year that you couldn't go straight from a Victor lawnmower motor into a 100cc Reed motor. Because, you know, it doesn't make sense, to be honest. So I had to quickly get my license. So I was about 4 foot, weighed about 40 kilos, and I was driving a 100cc Reed go-kart. I think the weight was 120 kilos or something like that. And the go-kart, you know, nobody could pick it up. It was, and they used to call me the flying helmet because I could, at the back of the seat, all we could see was a helmet. And at the front, all you could see was a helmet. So, and you know, it was crazy times. I mean, I'd never let my kid, I don't know what my old man was thinking.
Probably not much. Probably going, that should be me.
Can you just imagine putting a kid in a 100cc re-powered go-kart at 10 or 11 years old?
It's just going to test your commitment and passion, isn't it?
It was just insane. But, yeah. But anyway, I managed to scoop through that. So there was – after that, there was – that. Well, I was pretty – because my birthday is November the 30th, so pretty much nobody after that was allowed to go from – rookies into junior international. But but getting back to where we were, there was it took a couple of race meetings to get over there and get my race craft.
Find your level sort of thing, find top level.
Yeah, find the level, and you know, you have to pick it up and that's fantastic. It was times I'll never forget. And then we got the license and we were raced at the rally CIK meeting up there.
No, up there, Coffs Harbour.
Coffs Harbour, yeah.
Yep.
And my first race meeting there, managed to put on pole. And that was when I was like, okay, well, I think we've arrived. I think we can actually do this. It turned pretty quickly to poo after that, but
but
through the roller door we go.
On a one lap screamer, yeah, I was on the pace. 30 laps, yeah, not so. But then again, that was the first race meeting I'd done, you know, that sort of kilometres. You know, over here it's 7, 8, 10 laps.
Yeah, so the endurance factor came into a little bit.
Yeah, and the grip levels. I mean, the grip is just, you know, phenomenal. But
Were you bringing the car? Were you returning with the equipment and coming back, or was the equipment living over here and you coming to it when required?
Yeah, we just used to, because we didn't do that many races. Once we had the license, the CAMS license at that point it was just a case of, okay, we've got that now, we'll bring the go-kart back. But at that point, we did just send one over and leave it there. But that was just a clubby. As I say, we're clubby back, you know, whereas we're usually racing junior international or something at that point in time.
Yeah.
And then our next big mission was Hong Kong. And Hong Kong street circuit is just something else that will never leave me. That was a really amazing meeting. Again, it was put together at last minute. We had to fly. We had to take our cart as hand luggage or luggage.
Wow.
So we had our strip the go kart down and had the motors in hand luggage. We took minimal clothes, and you know, all our toolkits as hand luggage and all that sort of stuff, and you know. It was back before the days that they were too worried about that sort of thing. But there's, you know, you're putting a couple of Perilla motors up in your overhead lockers. you put them down a little bit from where you were sitting, just in case.
You don't want them coming through.
But, then we got to Hong Kong and we got our hotel room, which was about the 32nd floor or someplace, about 2 kilometres from where the track was. And we built the cart back up in the hotel room and then had to get it through the door and down the steps and into the lift.
What'd they say when you're moving across the foyer?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we had started it in the room and then the fire alarms went off. So, and then we had to carry it. We carry it from there. And I don't know if you've been to Hong Kong, there's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So we had to carry it from the hotel to the park firm, to the pits. It was, Yeah, real life. It was like a good fun weekend. Very last minute, not planned very well. If you were doing it again, you wouldn't do it that way. But super experience. And
Well,
I met.
how did you go after all that?
Oh, look, now I'm still going, mate. I'm still fucking finishing. No, not particularly well. That was again. That's a different. That was a different era again because there's no practice. You know, you get the track opens at whatever time on Friday morning. You get one practice session, then it's qualifying, and then you're into racing. But I met a lot of people that I met up with later in life when I moved to Europe. So it was good in that respect. Good in that respect.
What was the track like? Was it a permanent track or was it a street circuit that they had set up?
No, it was a couple of basketball courts, a couple of tennis courts, and it was super bumpy. Like, because, you know, when it rains in Hong Kong, it rains properly. So yeah. All the between the courts, what we'd call the, I suppose, the drainage was just filled with concrete. So there was remember at the end of the straight, you either had to be on it hard and get over the bump and then peg the brakes and make the corner, or you had to brake before the bump. It was right in the bumping, right in the braking stage. It was just horrendous. It was
perfect FIA track inspection there.
Oh, yeah. I think back in those days, it didn't matter too much. But it was, I mean, Google it. It is just some sensational racing, and the track was actually pretty cool. But then, you know, Sunday night your race is finished. Monday morning, all the kids are out there playing basketball and tennis, and like it never happened.
Yeah,
it was. Yeah.
And did you come home with luggage full of Seiko watches and video recorders like everyone did in Hong Kong in those days?
No, you'll never guess what we did come home with: all the good tires.
Yeah, okay.
I was going to say, all those kids would have been playing tennis and that with sticky rubber under their feet, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but no, we used to get all the good sticky tyres to bring back here because you couldn't buy that stuff in Australia at that point. So we used to, a few of us that went over there. I say Mike Sully was sort of a mentor at that point, and he'd been a few of these, so he knew the good drivers. You know, I met Jan Magnussen there, and I won't tell you about the nightclubs for Jan, but that's a different story. Another podcast, different channel.
But, different time slot.
But, we had a good night, good couple of nights. But, yeah, we used to get all his old tyres because they would do, like, literally one session on them and bin them. So, yeah, we come back with suitcases full of tyres. So, yeah. No Seiko watches.
Yeah, I just remembered that era. That was what everyone came back from Hong Kong with, was Seiko watches and video recorders.
Yeah, well, we did. Yeah, we went to, I can't remember what it was, but, computers were just getting big back
yes.
then.
Yes, yeah.
And they had this whole, place that was computer. And we went out there and had a look, and it was all above our levels. It was like, yeah, there's no tyres even. And then when we went
to no tyres. You sure you haven't got some tyres out the back? Yeah. An Atari 2600, but no tyres.
Commodore 64, 128.
There you go, I guess. Yeah. Cutting edge. Cutting edge. So you obviously got a taste of, let's call it, international competition with the, you know, your foray to Hong Kong. You've met Jan Magnussen, and things are, I guess, starting to get some momentum behind Shuri Costiera, the race driver then.
Yeah, it was sort of where it began again. Again, it wasn't like you would do it now, where every second weekend or third weekend you're flying over east or overseas or something like that. So, now we continue to do a bit of stuff in WA, a bit of stuff over east, and then one of the local dealers over here, Les Dean, started to bring these carts called a Solo in, S-O-L-O. Carts and motors are from England. And at the time, I was one of the better drivers over here. So he asked me if I'd be, you know, a sponsored driver. And I was like, well, hell, you know, I've never had that before. So that was nice. You know, it was like we did a bit of that. They weren't great, to be fair. Basically, they were just copies of whatever cart was going good or whatever engine was going good. And old mate would break them down and rebuild them into something else and change them a little bit and make them a solo. But we went to Philippines, competed over there, you know, with John Target was racing at that point in time. David Besnard, met him over there. So, again, it sort of got me knowing people. Again, I think we did pretty good in qualifying, but the heat of the day, 40-odd degrees, 36 degrees, 100% humidity. Yeah, didn't do so well in the end. But that was, I think I was about 20-odd, 19 or 20 then. And then on my 21st birthday, I said to the folks, I'm going to Europe for a holiday. So I'd finished my apprenticeship as a mechanic, raced around Australia in this solo go-kart, won the Queensland state titles, won the WA state titles, won some races, not the state titles, but some races in New South Wales, et cetera, on this go-kart. So it was like, okay. So when I went over there for a holiday, me and my mates, we did the 3-month European vacation. And then when I went to England, I went and knocked on Mr. Solo's door and I said, hi, I'm Stuart Costiera from Australia. I've been racing your carts, you know, in Australia and Philippines and blah, blah, blah. And we've got these results. What are the chances I can have a little bit of a skid over here? And he was like, oh, yeah, that'd be good. So we got wound up and I had to get a British license. And that was a bit of a jump through the hoops because they wondered why you wanted a British license. Had you been disqualified in Australia and you weren't allowed to race over there? And so we did a bit of, you know, it was always good fun working that out. But yeah, did the winter series over there and, it's a proper winter series. It's cold.
And wet. And wet. Let me guess.
Would have been a bit of ice and snow around, I guess.
A few race meetings, you know, you get all the cars out in the track to break the ice up, like cars, not go-karts, for about half an hour. And then you send it. And the funny thing was, back those days, we were running YDS Bridgestone tyres in we'll just call it Reed class for ease of it, which is a very hard tire. Over in Australia, we were running those tires as J tires, which was the lower category. So we're not only am I going to a really cold climate, but running really hard tires in the wet, in the snow. It's like, oh man, this is. So yeah, that was good. And I actually did all right. I did all right over there in the winter series. But it was when it came to the summer series, and you had to qualify for the British Championships. So there was a 4-race qualifying series that you had to qualify for, and you had to get X amount of points. And the first one was in the wet, and I did all right. And then the second one was in the dry, and the third and fourth ones were in the heat. These solo carts sort of. They were brazed together, let's say, rather than welded. And
once it got hot, oxyacetylene welding, hey?
Well, exactly, it was, mate. Once it got hot, mate, these things they didn't handle it all. So that's when I sort of turned to a couple of guys that I met in Hong Kong, and they were running the gold kart team in England. So I went and had a chat to them and said, look. You know, it's not working out for me here. I've qualified, but only just. But I'm not going to continue with these guys into the British Championship. And they're like, yeah, no worries, we'll have you along. Great little team. Got on really well with them, and we had a lot of laughs. And and that, and then yeah, it was just that the first year was just a year of learning, and then the end of that year, another team, Paul Carr Racing, who was affiliated with Terry Fulton Carts, sort of approached me and said, "Look, do you want to drive for us in the British and European Championships next year?" And I was like, "Well, of course I do," but you know, then you had to broach the subject with the folks.
Hey, Stewie, before you broach the subject with your folks, we had a good chat with Barton Moore on the Grassroots Racing podcast. His outlook on the English racing scene and living in England was a quite a bleak one. In between race meetings and in between times there, what was distracting you, or what was keeping you entertained in the UK?
Yeah, that's another podcast altogether.
Again.
I went over there with four good mates. They all left. Then I stayed, and funny enough, hooked up with this house that had about 15 people from my hometown, Kalamunda, in it.
Wow.
And then we just lived the London life. It was just good times and working. You know, I had two jobs, so I'd work all day from 8 till 5 at a motorbike repair shop, and then I'd work at a indoor go-kart center from 6 until 11, and I was doing that 5 days a week, and then racing on the weekends, and that, and it was just and I just had the best core group of friends that, and we're still my best friends. They just it was just the most amazing good fun times.
So the weekends we don't talk about were the ones that you weren't racing on.
yeah. Well, most weekends were testing or racing, but especially in the second year. But there was a lot of we just had a house, even back then, rent in London was $600 Australian a week. We're talking late 90s.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had to work hard, you had to save your money, I had a great time. And go-karts was just the cream on top. Yeah. I was having a great time with my mates and great time living life there and learning so much. And I wouldn't swap it. It was awesome.
No, that sounds good. And it sounds it sounds in stark contrast to Bart, wasn't it? Like Bart was sleeping in a caravan and washing in the truck stop, wasn't he?
It was, he was past the go-kart stage. He was
correct. Yes.
So,
he's into F3.
So the cars were, that's a lot more commitment than where I was at.
You were saying you were going to have to, the second year, you're going to have a chat back home to the folks and work out what the next move was with these new guys.
Yeah, so it was like, oh, look, I've been approached by these, you know, this team. You know, it's going to cost, I think it was 50,000 pounds at that point. So you can double that. So that was a year in go-karts.
Yeah.
So that was every British round, every European round, and the World Championships.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of racing going on. And it was, you know, it was a tough decision for my folks because they were back here working in the family business. And that,
you were having a time of your life.
Yes, pretty much. anyway, they come through. You know, they agreed to it. It was broken up into, you know, 10 payments and et cetera, et cetera. And You know, Paul Carr took me under his wing, and he'd, you know, pick me up from the train station. We'd go to the track, and that was a big learning curve then, because he was serious about go-karting. You know, the fun had stopped at that point. And I struggled a little bit to start with because it would always have been a bit of fun. But he's going, well, you know, if this is where, you know, he was a stepping stone in the future of British go-karters and all that sort of stuff. So it was like, you know, it struggled for the first couple of race meetings because all of a sudden it wasn't fun. It was very serious, and had to get knuckled down. But then when we started traveling Europe and racing against, you know, Jenson Button and Anthony Davison and Jarno Trulli and Giorgio Pantano and, you know, all these guys you look at back now, and you were sort of you were racing with them, and now they've, you know, they've gone somewhere and done something. And you know, I'm not saying I could beat those guys, but I was racing with them, and I was certainly wasn't being
Blown
out of that.
away, blown. Weren't being blown away. That's for sure.
No, I think I finished 12th in the European Championships and the World Championships. Yeah, funnily enough, got knocked out by David Besnard, fellow Australian.
He did he end up winning a world title?
I think he won the Japanese.
Yeah, he won something. I knew he.
But back in the days, he was one of the guys that beat. He was a very good peddler. As was James Courtney.
He did win a world title.
He won too. He did well. But yeah, the era I look back on, I was like, geez, I was unlucky. There's some bloody good drivers. There's some bloody good drivers in 1996. So I should have picked it that a year earlier or a year later. But that was fantastic. Just an amazing year, and got
Did the
some
fun
trophies.
come back into it for you, or was the whole year just your heads down, super serious?
No. Just, once I got to know the guys, excuse me, and once I got to know the mechanics, and this is another thing, you know, I always work on my own go-kart up to this point. And now you've got mechanics, and you've got tire people, and you've got all this going on. It's a bit overwhelming. But once I got to know the mechanics, and once I'd got learned to adjust my driving style, and being able to drive, and you know, the guys that I was racing against have raced in this environment all their life. So I'd only been in the British Championship 1 year, and then the European Championship another year. And to be honest, I think it would have taken another year, and it would have been a different story. But my mum got sick, so I had to come home, and you know, so be it. It was I wouldn't change it. It was just a great time. Got to drive some amazing tracks, met some amazing people, and you know, I still keep in contact with all these guys. I could rock up to England next week and go and drive their go-karts, and a lot of them are still involved. And it's just amazing. It's a really good time.
Tremendous, I guess, education for when you did return to Australia, because you landed back in Australia, and I guess you missed a beat a little while, and you touched on the fact that your mum got seriously ill, and then you know, you came home, and there, you know, you had learnt all of those things you just talked about. Were you looking to go on with the career to have some fun again, or was it still something where you thought, no, I'm gonna make it, this will be something?
Yeah, I was always old at this point. I was 21 when I was racing go-karts against 16-year-olds. You know, Jenson Button was 16, Anthony Davison was 16. You know, Charlie was 18, you know, and I was 21. So I was already well old. So to come back to Australia, I had to take a couple of years out because my mum passed away, and then, you know, dad was doing his things, going through life the way he was going. And then I rang up. At that point, Garth Tander had just won the Australian Formula Ford Championships. And I thought, oh, well, WA guy. So I rang up Brett Lupton at Fastlane Racing. I said, look, I'd like to come and have a go in your cars. You know, he didn't know me from Bar of Soap. And he goes, oh, yeah. Well, I spoke to his dad, Barney. He goes, nah, don't know who you are. Never heard of you. So I was like, okay. Well, how much does it cost? You know, so it was like, you know, X amount of money. I can't remember now. So teed up a test day and Garth was there. And he remembered who I was because we did a bit of travelling when we were younger together. So Garth gave me the sort of the heads up and the thumbs up to Brett Lupton. And that was a year after I'd been back. So I'd done nothing for a year. And then, got in a state Formula Ford series. And, first race meeting. He's up against a couple of go-karters and, you know, the red flag comes out and the guy in front of me just hits the brakes. Ooh. So I've just stoved into the back of this car. This is my first Formula Ford race. Stoved into the back of this car.
Sounds a bit like your first go-kart race.
Yeah, another canoe. So, yeah, the old man wasn't really impressed with my first outing. Nor was Brett Lupton, to be honest.
He's probably had better days.
Well, I did say to this other fellow, well, it's a red flag. It doesn't mean you emergency stop it in the middle of the straight.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, we got through that. And then, raced against some good fellas over here. And then the national round came to town and ended up taking, I think I got pole and then had a crash with Greg Ritter in the first race and bent all the steering, but still came through and finished second. And then the second race, I think I won, and then the third race I won. So I won the state round over here.
Which and is also the national round. Okay.
The national state round, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so it was like, oh, okay, was his game on now? but we still didn't have the money, so I only just finished that series. And then, I don't know if you remember, but used to have the there's a big Formula Ford race, the non-championship round at the end of the Sandown 500.
Yep.
Yeah, so it wasn't a championship round or anything, so it was just a free for all.
That was like the festival or something like that.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
It was something like that. Yeah.
Yep.
We went over that and it was wet and wet and wet. And I can't remember the result. I guess I can't remember the result because it wasn't very good. But
at least you didn't, the officials didn't have to get their cars out and get rid of the ice on the track, eh?
No.
Well, sometimes Melbourne could be like that, can't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Certainly can.
Yeah, so then the next year, I think it was 98, so we were 99, we're up to now.
Yeah, he did the whole championship that year, didn't he?
We started the whole championship, did really well in some. Fortunately, had a little bit of a bust up with Brett Lupton up in Queensland, where I was just not getting what I considered fair treatment in the team. We won't go into it, but so I pulled the pin on that year. So I think the first year I can, no, so the first year I did the whole championship and came fourth.
Yeah, that was 99.
Yeah.
That was in a RF94, which is a earlier model than the one you'd raced the previous year.
Yeah. So yeah, that was that year, and that could have easily gone way better, but again. But then, next year we did it again, thinking that we're on the money. And then we had a new car that Brett Lupton had designed, and I'd tested all over winter or summer, as it is over here, summer. And it was looking like a good thing, but then things just didn't turn out. It was always quick. I had some great results. I was running second or third in the championship at that point, and then had a disastrous weekend up in Queensland Raceway, except for the final where I drove from last to second. And the only reason I didn't win that race was because they never put a last lap board out. So I still thought I had more laps to go. And then I just got out of the car and I said, I'm done with you, Brett. It's not working out. So then the next year, I went with a guy that I'd met through Fastlane, Johnny Walker from Tasmania. He'd run Marcus Ambrose the same year that Garth and him were fighting. So that was 98, 99. And he ran me for that year, and we just had and he said to me from the start, this is a fun sport. If you're not having fun, we're not going to do it. And it changed my whole perspective on racing again. It took me away from being real serious about it to really enjoying my time in the car and doing what we're supposed to do. And and the results came.
Going to the racetrack and enjoying the experience rather than getting frustrated and angry with it all then.
Yeah. He goes, and he was an honest guy. He goes, chances are you're not going to go any further.
Nice.
You haven't got the money or the or whatever, so let's enjoy what we're doing. And we had a fantastic year. We had some great results, and again, didn't work out. I think I came fourth again. I think what was
you
it?
Did. That was 2001.
Yeah, so it was Davison, Will Power. Was it Jamie Winkler?
Winterbottom.
Yeah.
Oh, Winterbottom. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that came down to Sandown again.
At the Sandown 500, I think that meeting was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Johnny, we were both doing this on oily rags, and he had to sell had to sell my car because some bloke in New Zealand offered him silly money for it. So it was like, happy day. So I borrowed Tom Savery's car. Same car, but different. They're never the same. You've got one car you've built all year around yourself, and you jump in another car, and it just didn't pan out. As I say, this is why I'm a perfect candidate for this for grassroots, because look, the three guys in front of me that year all went on. The three guys in front of me a couple of years ago, the year before, it was Ritter and I can't remember, but and then
it's like Luke Yulden and in that time frame,
and all champion guys. I mean,
Glenn Hastings, I think, as well. In the mix,
I think Larko Ingle, they would have been about that time as well.
Yeah,
that's a bit early.
That would have been earlier 90s, yes. Yeah,
Ritter won the championship in 99. Adam Macro won it at 98.
And Adam GT, Macro,
GT, as you mentioned, he won it in 97. Yulden in 2000 and Will Davis in 2001. So they would have been around in the previous years before they won it as well.
So that was, so not bad company.
Yeah, absolutely. Great company. Hey, Stu, just before you go on, in 99, the Bathurst 3-hour production car race, you did you drove a Mazda at that. Mazda 626?
Chris Kaparis.
Was that your first ever, let's call it, drive in a race car with a roof on it, even though being a production car, but was that your first time in a tin top, let's say?
It was. And bad weekend. But anyway, it was that was the last year of the Driver to Europe series.
Yep.
Right. And the three guys in front of me didn't want to go. So it was offered to me to go to Europe and, do the Formula Ford Driver to Europe series. And I was like, oh, no, Leanne's just asked me to go to Bathurst and drive there. And I really want to drive Bathurst.
Yeah.
So I've chucked this European thing. Again, knowing that I couldn't afford to be there, nothing was going to go on with it.
Was that just a, sorry to interrupt, but was that the winner series or whoever elected to go. That was to do the festival in England,
the
wasn't it?
Yeah. You could drive. You drive the McGow. So yeah, that was that, and the three guys in front for some reason had already lined up their drives doing stuff, and so I was fourth. So it came back to me, and I turned it down. went to Bathurst with the Mazda 626 with Leanne and the team.
How did that go?
There was a deadly silence there.
I think it was $5,000 a lap.
You didn't get any laps.
Let's move on, because your production car racing gets a whole lot better than that in a few more years' time.
Yeah. No, we'll jumping forward. After that, I had a few years off. The old man said, "I think we've spent enough in this sport. You've sort of gone far. The business needs you. You need to start getting blah blah blah." So anyway, I was like, "Yeah, no dramas now."
Well, just before, sorry again, just before you did have a break, there was the Tasman Express Formula Holden NZ Series with Hocking Motorsport in the Renault, Formula Holden.
Yeah.
Which was four races, and you finished seventh overall. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was an eye opener. Coming from a Formula Ford into one of those, and the only test day I had was at Adelaide Raceway, and I was like, how hard can it be? It's a steering wheel, a throttle, gear shifts. And after about three laps, my neck had almost fallen off. I pulled into the pits, and they're all going, "Okay, so you've looked at the track, so you're going to have a go now." I was like, "Yeah, just give me a minute." And then did a couple more laps and spun out a bit and worked out the gear shifts and the power and all the rest of it. But yeah, that was an eye opener. But good, again, the Hocking team, good fun guys. It was again just a really good time, and to get to go to New Zealand and do those four races and sort of getting used to the downforce. I've never had, the downforce was just amazing. I still remember Paul Drumbrell at Pukekohe. He just took his rear wing off and goes, "Well, there's only three corners, and look how fast I'll be in a straight." I was like, "Man, you're going to die." He's the only one brave enough. And his lap times were good, but the car was undrivable. You couldn't drive it for X amount of laps. So, yeah, they put the back end back on. And I'm still where I see him now, just like,
shake your head again, dude.
Oh, you had to, you're like, if somebody said that to you, you just go, no, I'm not
that's
doing
right.
That.
Yeah, correct. See you at Manfield at the next round.
But he'll be there before the rest of us.
How did you go qualifying and racing in New Zealand? Were you up with them? Were you mixing it up?
Oh, look, the thing is, part of the contract was you have to pay for your damages. It was very cheap to get there and very cheap to race. But damages were your own costs. So, yeah, I was very timid to pass. Looking back on it,
Renault 97D wasn't cheap to fix, was it? Those front wings
$5,000 for the new wing.
Yeah.
Blah blah blah. So yeah, I didn't perform as well as I should have and could have. But by the same token, I didn't have a $30,000 bill at the end of it either.
How did you go with the Maoris doing the haka at the front of the field at the start of every race?
Mate, I'm probably one of the worst people when I go in a car or anything at the start of the race. I'm borderline asleep.
Yeah, right.
I don't get like once I'm in my cockpit and I've got my helmet on, my gloves on, and my seatbelt tight, and I'm sitting there. I don't watch anything else that's going on, and I can, you know, people take photos of me and my eyes are closed. And
yeah, yeah. Right, radio check, and then into Stewie Town.
Yeah. Beep. Whoa. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait for the lights to change.
Yeah, yeah.
Now there was also you know you did have a break there for a couple of years, but there was also some Porsche racing in what was the Nations Cup at the time as well, that you did a couple of races along the way in 2003, again into a tin top. Do you remember your first experience of driving a Porsche where all the weight's out over the rear wheels?
Yeah, that came through. It came through John Bauer. We were at Wanneroo over here for the touring car round, and I was having a chat with him, and he goes, "What are you doing?" I was like, "Oh, I'm out, mate. I'm finished. No money. It's work time. Blah blah blah." He goes, "Oh, I'm racing for a team doing GT." You know, he was racing a Ferrari at the time. And he goes, "We got a Porsche there sitting there doing nothing. I'll see if I can tee up a drive for you." So it was just a, have you got cameras on me?
Have
can
we
you
got
see me?
Yeah, no, yeah. We can't. You've got no.
No, I don't know.
You've got the video switched off.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, it was an old Porsche. And yeah, raced at Winton a couple of times in that, in GT.
Was that with Prancing Horse with Tony Raftus at the time?
That was with Prancing Horse, yeah. And then, yeah, that was just basically a road car, and it did all okay. And then, and that's where I met Maher Agadri, which we've all been waiting to hear about. And
I don't know, Stuart, yeah. What makes you say that?
Oh, he's a character. Going all around the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, met Maher there, and he was like, "Oh, you should come and do some more driving and stuff like that." So then the 12-hour, oh, no, the 24-hour was just after that. So I went to pit crew for the 24-hour race with Prancing Horse. I was a tyre technician. And I ended up saving them gazillions of dollars because every time they wanted to come in, they wanted to change tyres. And I'm going, "There's actually nothing wrong with these tyres. They're hot. They go. It's the middle of the night. You're not pushing it hard. You go out again." So, you know, a tyre that's run from start to stop doesn't wear out as fast as a tyre that you run it, stop it, run it, stop it, run it, stop it. So I think I was changing tyres on the cars every two pit stops, where they like allowed for every pit stop. So I saved him a fortune. So all of a sudden he was like, "Oh, you must come and run my race thing."
Straight away.
Because I don't know about that, man. I've got my own business and I live in WA. "That's okay. We get your tyre business in Victoria." I was like, "No." I don't want a tyre business in Victoria. I've got one in WA. I'm quite happy with the family run one I've got. Anyway, so I used to fly over. So then, so he had a couple of Formula 3s as well. So I've flown over there.
I was going to ask the question that led to the Formula 3 drive, I guess.
So I dragged his car from Victoria to South Australia. He hasn't turned up. So I've got a license. So I'm like, "No, I'll just drive it."
You mean he didn't show up? He's entered well, a race and he didn't turn up to the racetrack.
He just didn't turn up. So we're like, you know, it's Friday practice, he's not there. I can't get hold of him. So I'm like, me and, the, you know, there's another two guys. So, you know what? I'm just going to cross enter. I'm going to enter it. So I go up there and say, oh, look, Meher can't get here. He's caught up in business, blah, blah, blah. He wants me to drive the car. And you're like, oh, you'll have to get a letter from him and fax it to us. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I can't get hold of him. So I went down the pub.
As you do.
Yeah, you know, the one in the down the corner of
Mellala.
Mellala. Yeah. Went in there and said, oh, can I borrow your fax machine? So I wrote a letter. Blah, blah, blah. Stuart Costello can drive my car. Blah, blah, blah. Faxed it from there to the track. Went back up there. Did you get that fax from here? Yeah, we got it here. Good. All right. So I've
he sent it from the Mellala Hotel. It says across the
Yeah. I got to say the 05 number at the start would have been a giveaway too, wouldn't it?
I don't know, mate. I just I didn't wasn't thinking that far ahead. Well, that's or maybe I said that's where I'm staying. So I got in the fax there, and then I faxed it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Think fast at that point.
Yeah. But anyway, we got the fax, and they were happy for me to drive. So yeah, I got first driving a Formula 3. I think I got third or fourth on the day, so it was all right. And then Meher rings me up and goes, did you drive my car? And I said, yes. He goes, and you got third? I said, yeah. He goes, ah, we must get you one. And then he bought two, another. So that was an 01, I think. So then he bought a couple of 03s or 04s or something like that.
04s, 304s.
Yeah, yeah. But what Meher didn't understand is that the initial outlay is X amount, but you have to spend that almost every weekend.
You're away.
To keep the cars running. So
that was run under the Prancing Horse banner. There was a time where it was a Prancing Horse banner, but the cars were prepped by BRM. Am I jumping forward a couple of years or something with that? Am I?
Yeah, I think BRM. I mean, Prancing Horse has folded that by that time.
Yeah.
The old mate had passed on, and it was a different time. He just kept the name, and then. BRM ran those cars for Scud ran them for a year.
Is that Bill Maddox?
Bill Maddox is his team. Again, they were good fellas, good fun guys, pretty casual. And Bill Maddox, you know, he's a legend of the sport, and he should go down as as something real special for what he had done for grassroots racers like myself.
That was with Lauren Gray as well, or more.
I was going to say with Lauren Gray You know, just, you know, guys and girls that just couldn't afford it. But and to be honest, I don't think he could either. But he was just one of those stalwarts that made it happen. But anyway, that he wasn't good enough for Meher. So then we went to BRM. But BRM liked to be paid. So again, it's sort of I remember rocking up for race meeting, and the Kumo dealer wouldn't give me any tires. BRM wouldn't prep the car. It was and Meher wasn't there. So again, it was like, okay, well, I'm gonna go and buy my own tires. So I went, you know, paid for my own tires. And then sort of like got a few people I know in the pits, like, can you come and help me just run this car for the weekend? And you know, we had some good times. I don't know if you've got this on your funny list, but you know, that time at Phillip Island when I was a safety car period, and then we were all going down the straight for the restart, and I crossed but didn't overtake the lead driver. I was in second.
Overlapped, is what we said.
Yeah, I didn't overlap, but pulled out.
Put out of the lineup. Yep.
Put out
Oh
of line, which you're allowed to
you're allowed
do.
to do.
And then 2 laps later, got the black flag, and I'm livid. This is my first Formula 3 win. I'm like miles in front. It's all going well, and I get the black flag, and I ignore it for 2 laps. And then they're on the cans. You've got to come in. So, drive down the whole pit lane with my legs doing the driving and two hands out the window with the birds above.
Saluting respectfully.
Saluting the officials and
I
all the
think
rest.
your decision was wrong.
Just want to make my point.
This is your chance to reconsider, although.
And then, finish the race in third or fourth or something like that. And I was livid, I was like so unhappy. And then, of course, I got pulled up for disrespecting, the X amount fine. And I said, look, hang on, before we go any further, let's just go and review the video because I don't reckon I was in the wrong. And I reckon you guys owe me a race win and also the 30 grand that it cost to get here. So they went and looked at the video and blah, blah, blah. And they were like, now, not a good decision on our behalf, but it stands.
They're not, they never reverse decisions after the event.
Stewie, I had the same thing at Phillip Island, and it was in the era where Phillip Island didn't have it. Well, no racetracks had a speed limit down pit lane, and I pegged fourth gear in the race car and then jumped on the picks to stop at the end of the pit lane. And the family dinner table on the Sunday night, because the old man just happened to be the clerk of course, was an interesting affair. Interesting affair, very interesting affair in the early 90s, that one. Hey, Stewie, I want to jump to 2007. Car being run by BRM. You won the opening race at Sandown, and from the outside, and you can correct me on this because I don't know the actual facts, but it seemed as though that you'd done that, you led the championship in 2007. It was, for many people, and I conferred this with Richard Crail today, the pinnacle year of Australian Formula 3, 2007. Charlie Hollings, James Winslow, Leanne Tander, Tim Macro, and it was on that year, and you'd won the opening round. What stopped the rest of the year?
The guy that pays the money that doesn't get well, we had a brand new motor for the start of the year as a Mercedes motor. They were amazing, but they need to be rebuilt regularly. And we just didn't have the funds, and the sponsors didn't have the funds or whatever to get the fresh motors. So we ran that motor all year, and they just ran out of grunt, is what
So
it
it
comes
was slowly, you were just being picked off easier than what you were at round one, sort of thing. Is that how it
down.
played out?
We all had equal horsepower at the start,
Yep.
and then it just came down to it was just I mean those motors are fickle, they're very fickle, they're a couple of horsepower here and there is a big difference. So,
Absolutely, it is.
that's
Absolutely, it is.
again. But at that point in life, I was in it for the fun still. My racing wasn't going anywhere. I wasn't going to be a V8 touring car driver or going overseas or anything. So, as upsetting as it was still just amazing to be able to do this and be sponsored to do it. Those years in Formula 3 didn't cost me a cent. It was amazing. A really good time in my life.
Certainly was from the outside looking in, calling a number of those races, particularly the Victorian ones with at Phillip Island and at Sandown. The competition was equal to Formula 3, I would say, just about anywhere, any region in the world at the time. That you know, Winslow coming along, Timmy McRody's the height. Leanne Tander won her first ever, you know, first ever female won a race in the Gold Star. It was full on. It was a real, real open wheeler racing in Australia that we hadn't seen, I'm going to say, probably since the heady days of Formula Mondial Pacific Atlantic, as we learnt in our last podcast with John Bow. But that really came alive, didn't it?
Yeah. As I say, I was just in the worst period of every part of my life. And when I say the worst, I mean the best, because I was every go-karting, Formula Ford, Formula 3, just got to race against the best guys and girls that were available in Australia and the world at that time. And that's why I aspire that, you know, I really had a great time in my career in that period, because, you know, I can sit back with my kids and say, you know, I raced against this guy, I raced against that girl, I raced against this guy. They don't believe me, but it's...
Well, the next road trip, they're going to have to sit down and listen to this podcast and learn all about it.
But, yeah, no, it was really good. I mean,
Well, I guess if we look at it, like you're already talking about, you know, you're into two decades of racing cars for the enjoyment of it, and really, if we're judged on checkered flags and championships and race wins, your best years are still to come, and they're going to be in a tin top, not an open wheeler, aren't they?
Yeah, and a few years after that, I had a little bit of dry spell, and I met a guy. You know, he got me confused with my dad, because he's my dad's age, and he said, do you want to come and drive on this, you know, it's one of these street events. And my dad said, no, I can't be bothered doing that, but I'll, you know, my son will do it, because he will drive anything. that's when I met Glenn Crimp. And so we did this this event over here, and then he rings me up about 6 months ago and goes, oh, would you be interested in doing the Bathurst 12-hour? And I said, yeah, I think so. You know, I could probably stretch myself to that. And that's where the tin top thing really got going. And, you know, we had a meeting over here after Targa West, where Alan Heathie was running a couple of cars. And we sat down at Burswood with Alan Heathie and Glenn and myself and said, look, we want to put a car in a 12-hour. And he goes, well, let's do it. So that's when the tin top career started. And funnily enough, driving an F3 and a turbo Evo aren't that dissimilar in a lot of respects, because with a turbo lag of an Evo, you've got to get on the power halfway around the corner. You don't wait to get around the corner, because you got to put power on, then you turn in, and then the turbo lag will stop, and then you get out of the corner. So not dissimilar to driving a Formula 3, whereas you turn it in, get the wing to stick, and then you stomp it and get the aero happening. So, you know, straight away I was doing times in the Evo that people were like, wow, that's actually pretty good. So, yeah, that's where that all kicked off.
So you did, you end up winning 3 championships in production cars, in Evos, with a variety of drivers and teams, as it turned out, because you just didn't stick with one team. I think you were with Eastern Creek Karting for a while, the CX, the global team, a couple of different teams that you raced with.
Yeah. It all started out with TMR and Alan Heathie and Glenn Crimp. You know, they did their best for a couple of years, and then Glenn, being Glenn, he got bored of that and he wanted to move on to his next project. And so I did another year with Alan, just ourselves, and Ian Tullock, yeah. Inky. Yeah.
That was an interesting story there, because it was always only the driver change in the races.
Yeah, I only won the championship from pole positions in qualifying.
Yeah. But there was also the problem with the driver change out. I think Inky started the races and you finished them. Is that the way it worked every time?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Because of the driver changeover.
Yeah, he's a tad bigger than me.
Just a bit.
And there was there must have been the one we must touch on, the race that you did finish, but you were leading and didn't get it.
Yeah, it was a classic. All right. Well, it was just me and Dylan had been good mates throughout the production car series, and we'd done a few races together. And it was like, okay, let's team up for this year, or let's do a couple. He only wanted to do a couple of set races, and I was like, yeah, I'm cool with that because I'd supply the entry and some tyres, and he'd supply the team. So yeah, worked good for both of us. And so yeah, we'd done this race, and we were leading, and I didn't have any comms, so I knew it was getting late
because it was getting almost dark by that
stage. It was getting dark.
It was dark,
and I knew we had to do a petrol stop because I knew. So, but I also knew we're 2 laps ahead. So I was like, well, I'm just going to coax it and coax it and coax it. And I'm like, it's getting darker and darker and darker. And I'm like waving in the window, like, what are we doing? And they're like, just waving back.
We're having ice cream cones. Do what you do.
And then they get, because we don't have any, they didn't have any pit boards because we got comms. We don't have comms. There's no pit boards. And they got this little bit of cardboard. And I have no idea where it says in or out. I'm going to stay in or come out. Because I stay out or come in. So I'm like, oh, look. And the next lap I went through, and it started the a fuel surge between turn two and turn four. And I'm like, oh, we're in trouble here. I'm in trouble. So I backed right off. Come into the pits, they splashed it. The time I got to the end of the pit lane, the light was off. It was red. And not only that, there was 3 marshals standing in front of it. So it's not like I could just blast through it and pretend.
But didn't the checkered flag come out as you came into the pits?
Yeah, the checkered flag came out as I came into the pits, but my eyes aren't that good. so, yes, we this is all on video. We passed the checkered flag because, as far as I know, the rules are the pit lane is still part of the racetrack.
Yeah, they had to actually define that after that incident, I think, from memory as well, didn't they?
So anyway, that was cost poor old Dylan about 10 grand in fees chasing that win after the fact. But anyway, we went back next year and smashed it, and we won it. So
I got to say, we were quite grateful when that checkered flag came out, because I'm looking at my ticket back home to Melbourne, and the race is still going, and Gaz and I are still calling this race, and I'm like, Gaz, you're going to have to do these last 5 laps by yourself. But in the end, I was like, oh, I'm glad I hung around for that. That is going to be
we're actually the age. Dumbfounded.
Yeah,
at that
absolutely
stage.
Dumbfounded.
Why is he pitting when the checkered flags come out?
The timing screen still had you in the lead, because there's a timing line in pit lane. So it clocked that.
There is a timing, exactly. There's a timing line in pit lane.
Yep.
And when you do a lap count, right?
Yep.
So when somebody does 287 laps and you don't win, but the winner does 285 laps and win.
It was a 4 hour, I think, wasn't it? It was a 4 hour, and it was a lapse time.
Yeah, that was only, I'm only making those laps up. I don't know what.
Yeah, what you're saying is correct. You did more laps than the car that was given the win.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think if you look on NatSoft viewers, listeners, it's still there to interrogate that information. I think it might be rectified as the win, but I think the laps are still there for all to see. Hey, working, just going back to Team Mitsubishi Rally Art and working with Alan Heafy, you know, a guy that has had so much success, not behind the wheel, but engineering cars. Did you learn much in that time working with Alan?
Oh, look, that was a pinnacle of my career working with Alan, because obviously he's worked with
a lot of guys and a lot of special people, and he made a lot of stuff happen, and he's just so clinical and so relaxed, and he brings that through in a team. There's never any panic in that team. And you might come in with a wheel hanging off and a car on fire, and which has happened. And it's just like he's just like, this is what we're going to do, and it's just no stress, and it happens fast, and it's he brought a lot of clarity to my business, and I said, that's what I've got to be like in my business. If I want my business to be successful as well, you've got to be you've got to show leadership and clarity, and you can't run around with your arms in the air like a headless chook. He's taught me a lot, and the teams that he's run and still continues to do in a lower key way are just probably still one of the best race teams in Australia.
Yeah, and he's still a behemoth in the pit lane of production cars. That's for sure. When he's working with someone, he's there. That's for sure, because that car generally does a pretty good job. They get to the end of the weekend and drive it onto the trailer. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a couple other things I'd like to touch on if we can. A little bit of return to karts. Supercarts, but still, that must have been a little bit of an eye opener, considering what you've done in the past and how quick those things can be.
Oh, look, they were great fun. I remember my man. So I said, oh, I'm going to Phillip Island this weekend and race supercars. He goes, why? And I said, because they're pretty much the most fun thing in the whole world, and I honestly don't understand why there is not 100 go karts out there racing supercars. They are phenomenal. They are fun. They're fast. They're hard to drive. They're rewarding. I've still got one now, only 125cc one, but
You raced the 250s.
I raced the 250s back then, but unfortunately, the engine builder had a lot, I don't know, bit of line in his glasses or something that made him not see where they should have been built. But anyway, we're not going to go there. But
move on.
But they are just the best thing. They are so much fun. They are just unbelievable.
Actually, you got the race against Darren Hossack, I think, from memory.
Yeah, Hossack. So I raced against him in go-karts back when we were kids.
Yeah.
And then raced against him in supercars, and he's a good fellow. He's a hard charger, and unfortunately the equipment I had wouldn't stay together long enough to put in a decent performance. But I still swear by them. I still think they're a Formula 3 at a third of the cost.
And the suspension is in the tyres.
And Formula 3 didn't cost you anything.
Well, yeah, not at the but nor did the nor did the supercar. But they're just amazing bits of kit. They are just so much fun. But they just need to make them more reliable, because I flew all around the country, and I don't think I've ever finished a race. It's just diabolical.
Well, interesting you touch on Hossack, because he holds an amazing, stat in his list, is that he won the Sports Sedan Championship and the Supercar Championship in the same year. If you could pick two different versions of a racing vehicle, then that'd be it.
Yes and no, because they're both fairly high powered. They're both fairly good downforce, and they both need a fair bit of driving. The supercars, you got to hold on to them. They're a serious bit of kit, and so would a sports sedan. I mean, I drove a Triple B rotary sports sedan over here in the early 90s, well, late, you know, mid-90s, to where Sports Stand Championship over here. And that was a mad thing, you know. So imagine what that thing he was driving would be just out of control.
Stewie, in recent times, your records show that you've been racing some F1000s, which are the motorcycle-powered, train-driven cars, often of Ralph Firman design or wherever they're coming from these days. But that's obviously a local series that you're running in Western Australia. Is that keeping you happy? Is that giving you need for speed? If I'll quote a Top Gun quote there.
Yeah, they're a cool thing. They're in between a Formula 3 and a Formula 4. They've got aero but no power. So you know you really got to be on your game. And I did a couple of race meetings over the last. Few years, just one-offs to keep my license. And then Arise Racing, great guys they are, sort of said, well, come and do the whole series. And which I did and had a great time and managed to win a series. And, you know, that was my last hurrah in cars as far as it's been gone now, because it's like, you know, I was, what, late 40s at that point. And I was like, you know, I'm going to start saving my money for my kids. I've got two boys. They're going to be expensive.
At some point. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's
Have right. they got an interest in doing car racing?
Oh, they're too young at the moment, mate. You know, but...
Two more flying helmets?
Yeah, quite possibly, mate. I reckon, you know, it's either that or mountain bikes. So there'll be adrenaline. There'll be adrenaline involved somewhere, whether it's cars, motorbikes, or push bikes. Yeah,
you're always safer strapped into a vehicle, into a pod, into something rather than a mountain bike. And I guess motorbikes. I remember when Steve Martin had his massive crash in the late 90s at Phillip Island. I spoke to him afterwards, and he said, "You racing car drivers are mad, you know." Like I said, "Mate, you're standing in front of me, broken sternum, broken arm," and so, what was the accident that you had yesterday? And he said, "Yeah, well, the bike had a massive crash. I was watching it as I was sliding down the road. There was bits flying up all over the place." And he goes, "You guys are in that crash, like you're inside that car and rolling along." And I'm like, "You're rolling down the road with nothing around you."
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I'm right. I'm not crashing. I was like, oh, I've always looked at motorbike riders and gone, you justify it however you can, mate. That's all the
best. That's not a bad way to look at it.
Oh, well, I guess that's how they justify it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, Stewie, we are 1 hour and 25 minutes into this. You thought you weren't even going to get an hour up. It's been an absolute pleasure to have a chat to you. And there's always a couple of things that Gaz and I like to ask when we're coming to the end of our chat, and that is a protagonist. It doesn't have to be a driver. It could be a team manager. It could be a paddock marshal. It could be a spectator or something that every time you rolled into the track, you looked over and you went, this was going to be a good weekend, but that dude's here and you're just not getting – I don't like you. Second part of that question is one single – biggest, best thing that ever happened to you at the racetrack. The very best thing when Stuart Costiera rolls over in 30 years' time and he's in his 80s and says, yep, really good day at the racetrack, that one.
Well, that's a good one, because a mate of mine just asked me that just a couple of weeks ago. And we touched on it earlier, where I had a really bad weekend in Formula Ford up at Queensland Raceway. And I was last for the final. And I had that Ayrton Senna SK moment where you can't do anything wrong and every lap is perfect and you're just in the zone. And you know, it was, you know, 30-odd or 25-odd Formula Fords in that race. And, you know, Queensland Raceway doesn't have a lot of corners. And I just pegged off everybody. And then, as I say, the last lap board didn't come out. Otherwise, I would have won that race from dead last to first in a Formula Ford race in that championship year, which was just unbelievable. And, you know, Dick Johnson was on the fence and John Bauer was on the fence and everybody's just going, what the hell is going on with this guy? And that was I've only had two pinnacle moments like that. Another one was a few years later at a track called Clay Pigeon in the UK. It was after World Championships, and just everything came right that day. It was Formula A, and I was racing the British Championships and just smashed the field. So just every now and then you have this clarity of it. And this is why a Formula One world champion does that every weekend, and us grassroots racers have it every 10 years. That's the difference. That's the difference. So I've had two amazing moments that I can clarify as I could do no wrong no matter what happened.
Yep.
And those two races were that. Whereas, as I say, a world championship Formula One driver probably has that every weekend.
Yeah.
There are two questions for me to finish
hang
up.
Hang on, Gats. What about the first part about the Euro?
I thought he might have dodged that one.
No, we'll give him the chance to dodge it.
Who did I turn up and go...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not, that person doesn't gel with me. I'm not for that person.
Oh, look, probably when I was a kid, probably Matt Negus over here. His dad was a touring car driver. They had a lot more money. He's still one of my best mates. But, I used to hate racing that guy.
Stewie, out of 43 podcasts, we've only had three or four that actually answered that. Everyone else has just like brushed that one through. But thanks for coming up with that.
Yeah, my apologies for that one, because I when you go to the second part of the question first, you think,
Gaz, your turn.
Yeah. The best or the hardest driver you've raced against, and your worst weekend at a motor racing event.
Oh, my worst weekend. And this is what lost me the championship in Formula Ford, is Queensland Raceway. And I dreamt about it the weekend before, where I'd finish no races. And I didn't. I got driven over. I got drilled. I got spun out. And at that point, it was Stewie McColl was first. I was second in the championship. Two rookies. And then we went there, and I dreamt that I had a bad disaster weekend. I did have a disaster weekend, and that would be the worst weekend I've ever had. And the worst part is I knew it was coming.
And the hardest or the best driver you've raced against?
I don't think I can answer that one, mate. As I said, if we go back through this podcast and the guys I've just driven against over the last 30 years, there's a lot of guys there.
They all right.
A lot better than me and a lot faster than me. And I was never really scared of anybody. But I think somebody said to me when I was quite young, they both breathe the same air. They both do the same toilets. It just depends on what's between your ears. It makes a difference.
Yeah. Although in this modern world, I'm not sure whether you turn left or right into the toilets anymore sometimes when you go, oh, hang on a minute. That's not what I remember it to be like.
Nobody scares me. There's a lot better than me, but they don't scare me.
I tell you what, Stewie, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Race Fuels Grassroots Racing podcast. Your honesty and your thought through this whole chat now out over an hour and a half has been absolutely fantastic. And I always admire the races that are in Perth that come and race on the East Coast. Your great mates of our podcast, Tony Riccadello, has done it for so many years with so much success, but it just adds a different level of commitment, passion, difficulty, budget, all of those things when you're trying to race all over the country, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but we also come with a little bit more passion when we get there, I think.
I think you're right. I think you're right. You've made the distance. You're here at the racetrack. You're going to keep racing till they close the gates at the end of the weekend. There's none of it. Oh, we'll just pack up and go home now, is there?
That's right, mate. 100%. Yeah.
Well, Stewie, from the two of us, I'm not going to speak for Gaz, but from me, thank you very much for your time. And it sounds like just the staff clocking off and leaving you there to pack up the tie joint for the end of the end of the week.
Yeah, I've managed to miss that. So cheers for that, fellas. I do. I've probably missed out on a beer or two, but I'll make it up.
It's been an awesome chat. Certainly covered a lot of ground. Had quite a few good laughs along the way. And the chat really reflects the way you've gone about your motor racing.
Yeah, no, thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate you guys wanting to hear my story, because it's my story, and it'll be, interesting to see if anybody else likes it. So,
Just before you do go, Stewie, just for those listeners of ours in Perth, where do you get your tyres in Perth? Where are you?
Of course, you go to perthmotorsporttyres.com.au.
There we go. There we go. And you don't have to be from Perth for that either, do you? That's an international website.
It is for Toyos. Yeah, Toyo is the only Australian distributor for Toyo tyres, for motorsport tyres.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Dewey, and we will bid you adieu.
I love you. Thank you very much.
Say adieu.
See you guys.
You've just listened to a Speed Cafe Pod Hub production.